I got so annoyed at myself for saying interesting so many times. Hello and welcome to Keyframes In Betweens, a mini podcast about anime. I'm your host, Ben Halliburton. With me today is Andy.
Hey, hey, hey.
And Duncan.
Hey there.
In this episode, we are talking about Akira. I know it's a pretty obscure movie that a lot of you have not seen, but we figure we want to give it a bit of a broader audience because we think this one's going to really hit with you someday.
Yeah, it's going to pop off. It's definitely going to pop off.
Yes, so this is the 1998 movie written and directed by Kazuhiro Otomo, who also did the manga, which we will also be discussing, about our current situation, kind of, minus the psychics.
We'll get to it later, but I think it's more about our past than how we are now. I think we've moved past where Akira was thinking we'd get to, which is a strange thing to think about. But
Andy, why did you choose this as a tween topic? I mean, we all love Akira, but
I haven't really seen Akira that many times. I've seen it once.
Really?
Back at university, and it didn't really land with me. And then I got a bunch of adverts on Instagram being like, oh, it's the 35th anniversary of Akira, or at least it is in the UK.
Yeah.
It's getting a 4K IMAX re-release. And I was like, I'd like to go back and re-watch it, revisit it, see if my opinion's changed. And I mean, obviously, yeah, they have. Like, it's a fucking stalwart classic for a reason. So yeah, that's why I chose it.
Well, if you are not familiar with it, or if you need some refreshing, Akira is the story of two bike punks in a crumbling near future Tokyo that has barely survived a third world war. And one of them meets a psychic kid and stuff starts spinning out of control, resulting in arguably the birth of the universe. We'll discuss that too. Who wants to go first?
Having rewatched it, I really like. It's really good.
The fact,
bam, fact. Yeah, the thing that really hit me this time around was just like how much time they spent making this like world like feel livable. Like it's like low futurism, but it's like grimy. It's dirty. There's that opening shot where like one of the persons taking one of those psychic kids through like a blockade, and just the way that all those people are just sitting there being like, yeah, another day, another blockade, another student protest. And also like sort of like the shock when Kay kills that guy. Like they really focus on this guy,
that scene
melting into the like into the sea, and you get her sort of trying to comprehend it and make sense of it emotionally.
The resistance subplot and the general social unrest is really fascinating, and it's something that I think about because I'll have a lot of good and bad things to say about the Akira manga, but it is an empty city, like depopulated of people in the manga. And I think one of the things that makes the movie spark a bit more to me is that in between Otomo writing the manga and making the movie, Oshii did the Kerberos saga. And I think that a lot of like the like Jinro stuff influences him. We have these student protests, we have tax riots, we have these confrontations in the street between mass crowds of people and the police that aren't really present in the manga of Akira. It's more of a shutdown city where like the kids are out riding on bikes because the streets are empty because the police have everyone locked down. It's curfew. And so instead having these like seething mass of people and having this resistance cell doing its thing, trying to free these psychic children in the midst of the general like slow decline of government, like the detail that there's this executive council that is making all the decisions arbitrarily, that there's a military coup,
and they're all old,
and everyone's old, everyone's corrupt, everyone's,
and they hate the young blood.
The setting of the 1970s social unrest kind of telegraphed out into a dying state is really powerful, and I think if it took place in a regular, just like near future cityscape, I don't think it would be as striking as this, you know, even if Tetsuo does not blow up the world, Japan is not long, not lasting very long.
Yeah. I think like what Andy hit on then about how Kay reacts to killing that guy is actually really sort of important to its central themes. Mm-hmm. You've referenced it, Ben, when talking about the manga, that Tetsuo just kind of becomes a bit of a psychopath.
Why is the characterization better in the movie than in the manga?
But even in the movie, he basically starts sort of doing these things without any empathy to the... He's spent his whole life without power, and now he has it, mm-hmm. and he...
He gets to be the bully.
Yeah. And yeah. Kay's regret over that and just sort of like... That look in her face as she realizes what she's done. Like, we never get that look from Tetsuo. Like, even when he's beating a guy to death, it's more over, like, his own humiliation that he wasn't able to stand up for himself. Like, I think it's really an interesting in terms of, like, where this existed in history, in that this came out in 1989, which is the year the Berlin Wall fell. Like, 2 years before the communism is just gone at as a force in the world, where we basically arrive in what people think of as the modern era. And it's sort of prescient that pre that, like, you have this outward enemy, you have this class of ideologies. Post this, a lot of entertainment sort of turned to the enemy within, turned to sort of like government, their secret project, aliens, so on and so forth. The threat starts being science is out of control. Actually, I mean, that's a classic, mm-hmm. but still, it becomes more of a preoccupation. We need to find new villains.
It's interesting, especially because one thing that the movie adds is that, like, the government is in a financial crisis because of incredibly unpopular tax reforms, and yet they have spent trillions of dollars on Akira, and it makes the Olympics, the construction of the Olympic Stadium and the massive, like, cryogenic facility under it even more egregious. The idea that, like, there's always money for military industrial bullshit is something that I guess maybe as an American, having been alive the past 40 years, it's very telling. The idea that this city is falling apart and what the powers that be are choosing to shore up, and even what the revolutionary forces, Ryu and Kay and their rat-like patron Nezu on the executive council, who dies of just having too much aspirin.
I love that there's that whole bit where it's just like, there's a mole in the council. Who could it be? Oh, I'm Mr. Nezu. It's like, it's the guy who's literally called Mr. Rat. Like,
yeah, I was going to say.
Just like, it couldn't be him.
Hi, I'm Mr. Mole. I represent the 4th district of Neo Tokyo.
Also, like, the imagery of the Olympics being this sort of thing where all the nations join together in a bout of, like, competition, fun competition, and then the idea that there is just this thing that is going to blow up the world is hidden right below it is kind of, it's a fun, like, symbology that, and also just looks kind of badass. I don't know why there is a massive marble throne in Olympic, but I don't remember there being one in any other one, but, like, they were like, yeah, let's put it in, it will look really dope, like, and it does.
that's also something that comes from the adaptation process. It really intrigues me how the movie is really just a straight adaptation of the first two and a half, three volumes. But there's things that get pulled in from the later volumes that he weaves in, and the throne is one of them. Like, there's a throne that's just like a crumpled building that's just like barely standing up, and there's a throne on top of it. And they transpose that to the Olympic Stadium. And in fact, the fight in the Olympic Stadium happens later than the fight that's being depicted in the manga. We weave in these elements, and the show and the story doesn't tend to suffer from compression as much as you might think. Kaori is just some girl that Tetsuo raped in the 4th volume then sticks around, and instead she's his girlfriend, and it means that he has someone to interact with who's not Kaneda, which means we can see a side of him that's not just seething with anger and jealousy, and he wants to be the kind of person who can beat up three clown punks and save his girlfriend. And instead we have this, I found it actually really powerful, like, once the biker gang has saved Tetsuo and Kaori from the punks, and she's just walking up with Kai or Kaisuke's jacket over, and she's just, her face is just a bloody swollen mass, and she's just like, stop, stop fighting, which is what, like, the only way to avert disaster is to stop fighting. And unfortunately, because of the social environment, the personality of these horribly traumatized children who just get the shit kicked out of them at their, like, awful prison school every day, like, they can't. Like, Tetsuo cannot stop hurting people.
Mm-hmm. Because he doesn't know any other way. His language.
Even the person he looks up to, even Kaneda, who's much nicer and, like, friendlier and more mm-hmm. pro-social in the movie, he's a fundamentally violent person. Like, the reason that he gets involved with the resistance is he just keeps throwing himself into danger to beat people up. Yeah.
Well, the reason why he gets involved with the resistance is because he wants to get into Kay's pants. Like, Kaneda is incredibly simple, like, motivations, I feel. Like, I don't really know where he gets that gun from. Like, that was a cool gun.
Just literally picks it off a dead guy at a checkpoint.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I missed that.
He goes to a checkpoint and he goes, huh. And then he picks up and he knows to take a spare battery too, which is good. Yeah.
Smart guy.
Yeah. Well, no, absolutely not.
Yeah, absolutely not. Yeah. But, like, his bike looks dope and he knows how to ride the bike because he could rev it at 5,000 or something.
We gotta reference the Akira slide, which...
So early on, I thought it was a lot later. Like, the movie goes at a pace. Like, this is the other thing that I didn't really, like, appreciate at the time, but it goes at a clip. There is so much in there that is, like, asks that the audience are intelligent enough to pick things up, and then also just, like, that they can just interpret the current world, the state, the politics, like, just by looking at what's going on in the world that they're living in, and also the sort of grim realization that 35 years on, nothing has changed. Like, this is all still just as much a possibility. Nuclear war, that's still very much a stress and a...
I mean, one thing in Akira is, like, we see that nuclear explosion at the start, and did Akira cause it, etc., etc. And I honestly, like, feel like, in a weird way, our version of that was COVID. Genuinely. I'm not even joking.
Yeah.
Like, we've got to this point where technology is basically magic, and where sort of, like, faith in governments had been sort of teetering for a long time. And we'd had all things like Brexit and the rise of the Tea Party and then MAGA in America. And, like, I think COVID sort of, like, brought those two extremes where we had people's faith in medicine just completely gone. Like, one thing about the manga, as Ben will no doubt say, is that there's a lot more drugs in the manga.
Oh, holy shit, there's a lot of drugs. Everyone's doing drugs all the time. Like, it was wild in the movie when he's just like, put them on level 7 drugs. And he's like, is that safe? And he's like, yeah, probably. And, like, as opposed to just like, just pills. He's got, like, a mound of pills and he just, like, sticks in a handful and just, and it's like, and they're explicitly amphetamines, which is also very 80s, I feel like. He's like, amphetamines will unlock human potential. That's Nazi shit, man. I don't know.
Like, there was the whole war on drugs and everything from Nixon and then everything which followed from that in America and in the UK. All that anxiety of kids on speed, kids on ecstasy, etc., etc. We've got to this point where people just don't trust... Like, I think there's a fundamental human anxiety about medicine anyway. Like, it takes a leap of faith. Like, we need the reassurance of a doctor to go, okay, I'm just putting this thing inside you. It'll be fine. And once that goes, once take this pill. It's not going to turn you into a psychic mutant. I believe me.
We've tested it.
And if it does, we have another pill.
We've tested it. Not on humans, but we've tested it. So, you know.
We saw that done at scale in 2020 where... people's anxiety about that just flared to unimaginable levels. We now, post that, are in a thing where pseudoscience has absolutely bubbled back up into the mainstream. Like, you can look over the whole milk drinking fiasco, etc. And even just a sort of, like, day-to-day level.
It really draws me in how well Akira, despite everything else, how well Akira, both the manga and the movie, see that this, like, compulsive societal, like, reactionary conservatism responding to, like, the terror of modernity. The colonel in the movie says, like, we're done building, we don't have the like political will to rebuild, so we're just going to rot. And that's, and like the idea that in the face of that sort of societal attitude, like people go back to cultish religions, people go back to like violent gangs. In a meta sense, the reference to the Tokyo hosting the Olympics is going back to the 1964 Olympics and sort of implications that that had for Japanese sovereignty, Japanese militarism, and indeed the militarism that suffuses Akira's world, where we have this executive council of elected politicians, but the colonel does a coup easy as day, both in the manga and in the movie. Like, yeah. it does not take any effort at all to topple this weak government.
It's like one charismatic leader. Like, he does one speech, and then the army's just like, you know, he's got a good point. Like,
and his speech is just, come on, things are fucked. Come on,
yeah,
and
like fucking, like, what are you doing, mate? Like, come on. And then they're like, yeah, good point.
I mean, yeah, well, they did shoot the guy, and his casualness into like, he's just like, shoot him, and they just shoot the guy and then shoot the other guy, and that's and compared to like Kay just being horrified that she's blown this guy's face off and he's watching him slowly sink into the sewer muck. I do have to say, though, bringing up the Olympics, I can't verify this link since it's in a published book, but apparently there were plans to have Kaneda on his motorcycle for the 2020 Olympics before before the pandemic delayed them.
Oh no! Well, I mean,
Andy brought himself around in 5 seconds.
Well, I was just gonna mention, like, the Akira like live action has like supposedly been in production, out of production, in pre-production.
Oh, it's been around forever.
It's been around forever, and it's always been that thing where I'm just like, why? Why bother like remaking this masterpiece?
Me
making
money! This stuff, like, what else? Money.
Yeah, pretty much. But like, you know, sometimes like I see some shots like the Akira slide, like the Cultural Revolution. Like, I can see why people want it in live action, but I just also then wanted to just go into just like, this movie looks gorgeous literally all the fucking time. And it is a testament to quality of just like hand-drawn animation. The budget, which I believe is one of, or is not the most expensive, like...
Yeah, the whole adjusted for inflation stuff makes it really hard to tell, but it's up there.
Yeah.
Yeah, 700 million yen is to a billion yen is like the thing, but the estimated budget, but like... Holy fuck, does it look gorgeous on every frame. Like, and it's so much different. And it's so much different when you're watching it and, like, you're watching it on, like, really nice, high-quality, like, TV, and it still looks great. And like, I just start appreciating just, like, motherfucker, they drew every single line. Like, there was no shortcuts in any of this.
I mean, I will say, like, I do think it is wonderful, but there is this scene when Kay and Kaneda have just nicked the hover bike. They're about to fly into the medical facility, where if these days any a prestige action and anime basically just panders across some stills to create the illusion of a bike zooming forward and then turning down a giant into a sort of ventilation shaft, it would get completely panned on the internet.
I'm pro pans over stills. Pro pans. Bring back pans over stills. Have your incredibly talented background artists just paint an amazing like cyberpunk background, which is very funny how the Wikipedia article is super defensive about how like Neuromancer was 2 years out and wasn't translated until 85. So Otomo was doing this on his own.
Yeah. I love the design of the hospital in particular.
The whole color like theory behind everything is incredible, and but there's just like shots when there's, I mean, I don't know how much computer imagery was done in it. I presume not a lot, but like when they're doing some of like the setting and like the reaction scenes where they're going through the city and there's, you know, they're like the first opening scenes where they're going through the city and then there's big fucking like TVs playing small clips of like independent news articles, which then smashes into like one big one. I'm just like, unless they could be copy and pasting that, they could be making like shortcuts on all of those
unless I'm completely wrong on my timelines, I think that is very much like a good half decade of early messing around with CGI and a decade or so from it actually coming into real use. But you are 100% right. It could fool you into thinking it is because it is done so well.
Yeah. If there's anything that's CG, it's the like... the little like spiraling ring that's like showing, which is introduced for the movie, which is just like Akira's power, I mean Tetsuo's power level, and that weird like dancing ring
that kind of works for CG because it's so alien. And I love that diegetic music that comes in every time they play that.
What we can talk about the music in general, but is there a single bad second of the soundtrack?
Absolutely not. The soundtrack is incredible. The like the pounding rhythmic polyrhythmic drums, like drumming circle kind of thing,
and
which
weird
again,
like no stuff like
and then like the Akira, like it fits into, as you were saying, like the religious aspect of Akira, and it goes into that sort of chanting that you would expect it, and it matches, but it never kind of gets in the way. It always compliments. It just hits the vibe, makes you go like, yes.
Yeah, this and the Kenji Kawai score for the first Ghost in the Shell movie are just like these ridiculous, like traditional Japanese soundscapes using like new electronic music and production methods to really have this bizarre, like familiar but futuristic. It's so good.
Yes, the biggest thing that futuristic element to it too, like the trancing, like repeatingness of it all, like
and that the biggest thing that's missing from the manga is honestly the movie soundtrack, and I read the last volume with the soundtrack playing on my speakers, and it was a lot better time.
We forget how new synth music and all that was when that was released.
And I mean, a lot Akira is, we were talking about this a little bit before the podcast recording, but like the idea that like the OVA boom had kind of like ruined the prestige of anime movies and theaters, and Akira is this big gamble where instead of like they came up with an entirely new color palette, which is a very expensive thing to do back then, and they really went for broke with this huge story. And you can, even with Ghibli movies, we were talking about, like, you can see the reaction to Castle in the Sky or to My Neighbor Totoro, which came out 3 months before Akira. And afterwards, it really does restore the prestige of these big tentpole anime releases. And it is because most of the scenes are at night. They have a completely bespoke palette. They're really able to tune in, like, the contrast of these bright neon and these, like, varying different color tinted grays and browns that really build this nightscape. When Tetsuo is getting attacked in the hospital by the giant toys that the numbers or the kindergartners or the children or whatever you want to call them, the impenetrableness of the darkness and then having these figures move out, it is such a visual feast. I agree completely, Andy. I was just like, I came back after a long shift. I was exhausted. And I'm like, I'm probably going to fall asleep during this movie. And I did not. I did not fall asleep during Akira because it's a ride.
I'm not sure if the term chromatic black technically correct in this case, but there is the way they use
it. It's useful.
Way they use the colors to create darkness rather than just changing the amount of black in a color, where you have these greens, these purples, these blues, these creating ambiences. This wonderful shot where they've gone down to where they're storing Akira. The whole thing's kept in like this cold, cold environment, and they're all wearing this like Arctic wear. And there's this little control room, which is the only bit where it has any light, and this control room's like glowing orange, and the rest of the scene's this cold, cold blue and purple, and it looks wonderful in those. And I also wonder, like, none of us have really got to see this as intended, because like this is made to be seen on a big screen, or even technically on like a CRT. That's how people would have viewed it while mastering it. They would have seen shots on those, and we've all seen them on LED screens or OE LED, and it's never going to be quite the same. I did like, there's some little experiment things you can do with modern cameras to try and sort of recreate that sort of feel, and I sort of played around with it a little while watching it, just to sort of like see how it would affect. When you get a light bloom from these things, the way that the sort of the smoke and the dust and the mist comes through is changes. It suddenly gains a translucent quality. And that was a really interesting little, oh, I wonder if that's what it's like. And the way that, obviously, we've got that, I've temporarily forgot the technical term, the old shine through of
overbleed.
Yeah. Maybe it's something which I'll when it does come out this September, I think I will try and see in the cinema just to get the authentic feel.
I would like to.
Because that is how it's meant to be watched, right? Like, you watch it on a CRT, but it's actually meant to be watched at a movie screen, which would have had it. I am also wanting to go see it now in the IMAX. But I was going to actually ask Ben, sorry, go back to something you said. What do you mean by the palette color they had to, like, redo?
I think this is in Susan Napier's... anime from Akira to Princess Mononoke, is that right, or something? But
yeah,
I haven't heard of it.
I looked, but it's slightly too far away for me to read with my ruined eyes. She has a chapter on Akira, and I meant to read it, but I was too fucking busy just reading Akira the manga. I think she does make a point that, especially with the current state of the anime industry in the 1980s, there's a stock set of colors that you have to paint. And if you want to mix more cell paints, that's an incredibly expensive outlay. But they mixed like a different palette than the standard palette you could just get off the rack.
Oh.
I wish I could give a page number citation, but I've read that in two separate places that they like spent the money to make sure that the night colors they'd have a big palette of night colors. And this was seen as like, this is going to flop. Like, this is a huge amount of money, and anime movies don't make that much money, so this is a waste. And it laid the groundwork for these tentpole anime movies, which have very unique visual styles. And there's a lot of consideration. I was wanting to mention, one thing I really liked watching the movie after reading the manga is when they go down to the cryogenic facility with the Doer's flasks. In the manga, they come down on the left and they move right, which gives the audience a feeling of direction and progression and purpose. And in the movie, it's the opposite. They come down from the right and they move left, which is wrongness and regression, and they're taking the wrong path is the idea. And so just that, implementing that visual language there, it's very natural for. And maybe I realize the Japanese reads from right to left, so that's probably why. And the manga's flipped, but still, it was interesting to see how that was. Yeah,
yeah, because I was actually going to mention it. I'm trying to find where I read it. Akira as a manga was one of the first manga in the UK that was ever fully finished. They flipped it to be more like a Western comic. But then they also colorized it.
Yeah.
And so the original manga was never colorized.
Just to double check, Andy, are you 100% sure that's what happened? Because I also know that they basically made a color anime manga out of the production artwork for the film.
In the volumes I have, the first five pages are gloss and colorized.
Okay, cool.
And they are thoroughly unremarkable, and I kept forgetting and skipping past them when I was opening a new volume and then going back and, oh yeah, this is actually like the first three pages of the manga. that bums me out because I thought I had something really, really hot there with the reversal of the direction, but it's just because they were so worried that this wasn't going to make an impact in the West that they flipped it. They redid all the sound effects, which I have to complain. I'm going to do a lot of this probably, but you can't just transliterate the Japanese onomatopoeia because onomatopoeia have different cultural dimensions. And so when like all the characters are reacting to something that's like brr, B-I-I-I-I-R, I don't know what that sounds like. What is that? Either translate your onomatopoeia, I don't know, or do something better. I'm not a manga author. I can't say. But it's a very titanic effort to make Akira a Western appearing comic, which is interesting to me because its sensibilities are so profoundly Japanese. And the Americans are bloody handed morons and murderers. The end of the manga is just the admiral just trying to carpet bomb Tokyo into submission until they bring a satellite down on his aircraft carrier. Which fundamentally ends the involvement of the Americans in the manga. But
when we're watching that little chase at the start, where one of the the children's being led through the crowds. Like there's this ad, there's this advert for dog food being played on in the background, and it may just be me, but it felt like the way that those dogs in the animation were done was deliberately like American style rather than like a Japanese style, because like there's definitely this idea that America equals capitalism. Even now, like that is Western. Capitalism has for a long time been synonymous, especially and even more so in 1989. I'm not sure Eastern capitalism was really something you had any real sense of, like, whereas now Japan and China and India and Malaysia all have like their own particular brands of it, and Korea as well. It was definitely seen as like a not a Western invention, but like it was strongly associated with America and like the Western bloc. I don't think capitalism and the money you which come with it is seen as like a neutral little thing in Akira.
It's no, absolutely not. It's interesting in the movie, the Japanese government hasn't fallen, and they've just kind of tottered after the war with these increasingly self-inflicted wounds. And it's clear that like the government's – anytime you have a council of 10 men in a room deciding something, like not going to last long. At some point, someone's like, well, I can shoot one of them, and there's 9 men, so my vote share increases.
And also props to that one guy who was just sleeping through all of it. I loved him the most. It was just so real. Like, it just feels like so contemporary even though.
I like the one guy who was like, we should focus on welfare programs. And I was like, shut up, old man.
Yeah, shut up. And then like, all the people are moving all the fucking time. There is rarely a shot where people aren't doing things, but like the attention to detail, the love to the craft, like mind-boggling.
The mindfulness of large frames with multiple things going on is not always present in anime directing, but I do feel with how busy Otomo's manga panels are, it's not surprising. And in fact, that becomes somewhat of an annoyance in the manga. It's just there are these huge panels with like 8 things going on, and you're just like, okay. And you like your eyes slide over it in a way that I don't always feel great about.
It can be too much, and it's not like you're not taking it in, but it's just like, it's harder when it's
rich.
Still, it's too rich, and you're just like, I got to read this book, man. I can't be staring at every page for 20 minutes.
I sped read the last volume, and it was a lot of visual work. But in the manga, like the government has fallen, and it's just barely managed to pull itself back together. And Japan is very much a nation that the rest of the world is dying to deploy peacekeeping forces to. And so the manga actually ends. The back half of the manga, and especially the ending, are just like, foreigners stay out. Like, let us rebuild our nation by ourselves. And it's very interesting to have that as kind of the final message, rather than the like more like esoteric, surreal message of the movie. It really is Kaneda redeclaring the Great Tokyo Empire, the bullshit thing that the captain, the regent-haired opportunist who like puppets both Tetsuo and Akira after the second Akira incident. There's so many orbs of energy in the manga compared to the show, but there is this like isolationism. It's like, let us work this shit out on our own. Don't like, you can leave food, you can leave medical supplies. We do not want peacekeepers in the street. Let us have our ruined country and just figure out where to go next. And I found that a very curious contrast to the movie, which seems to be about the death of Japan, but also the rebirth of Japan. And in fact, the idea of like, is this regression or is this rebirth, which I think is a line in the final volume of the manga, is the question. Is being a giant baby being reborn, or is it reverting back to childhood? And this is kind of tied up in like, is Japan destroying itself, or is it pruning away the rotten bits and we get something purer in this like gang of kids who do seem to love each other? And the idea that the reason that Tetsuo hates Kaneda is because he doesn't believe that Kaneda loves him. He believes that he's a puppet and a loser who's just meant to be mocked.
Which you kind of get from the first introduction, right? Like, he's like, don't get on my bike. You can't fucking ride it. Don't, like, you know.
But he's right. But he's right. He's right. He can't ride his bike.
He's totally right. But, like, it is that feeling of him just, like, I mean, there is love there and caring. And he's obviously, like, he wouldn't do half the shit that he's doing. But, yeah, like, it's good.
Yeah.
Ben, that's a good point. Like, there's this sense, like, of these contrasting things of like, do we impose our idea of what we should have been, of what we can be, or is it actually a compromise between different viewpoints possible? And like, Tetsuo and the Colonel are in their own ways just imposing their way of how things should be on others. But in Canada and Kay, you sort of get this collaboration of two people. Like, Kay's an idealist, and Canada is the most cynical grifter you've ever met. And
I love when he's like, "Hey, you killed somebody. That's cool. Go to jail, and when you get out, we'll get married."
Yeah, he was just like, that really made me laugh as well. It was just like, "Oh, it'll be fine. Don't worry about it, man. Like, come on, what are you going to do about it?" Like,
and yet that's our hero and heroine, and then these two incredibly different things, and there's not a sense of, oh, she becomes more cynical or he becomes more innocent. Like, it's just they sort of have an accommodation and an appreciation of what each other are. And, like, there's a whole thing which, like, the children sort of say to them, like, this sort of extreme version that Tetsuo sort of embodies, civilization isn't ready to have the sort of power he has while it still uses it like that, while it uses it selfishly, while it uses it in a way that is absolute. But in these two people who sort of accept each other and don't force change upon each other, or like the way Tetsuo treats Kari is, like Ben remarked on it earlier, but like it's almost like he just wants to possess her. Like, it's just like a mark of status almost for him. And like, looking back, like, that really fits with the quote-unquote power of Akira. Like, this, what did they describe it as, being like an amoeba, like just wanting to consume. Just wanting to.
That's interesting, because I thought that there was a lot more, because obviously there's like fighting between Kaori and like Tetsuo, like, is it him or is it like the Akira like taking him over? But I always assume that like Kaori is the first person he goes to after he gets out. Like, there is a genuine, from my opinion, like, there's a genuine feeling of affection and love from of Kaori from Tetsuo.
Maybe it's because I've read the manga as well, and that it's a far less sympathetic relationship there, and I'm projecting it onto the film.
I'm talking purely from the film, because I didn't get that at all from the film. Like, even when she comes in at the end, when he's like transforming, he protects her and he's just like, no, get away. Like, he feels her pain and hate and doesn't like it. Like, there's none of that in the anime.
I wouldn't say there's none, Andy, because like the whole scene we discussed earlier, where he's beating up the guy who attacked them. It's like, as Ben said, like, she's coming in, and she's like stop that, and he's doing it for him. He's not doing it because he's protecting her.
I think what makes the Kaori relationship interesting, she kind of reveals to Tetsuo how like shallow and childish he is. That like, if he was a real protector, he'd be focused on her. But he keeps defaulting to his own needs because he's immature and because he doesn't know what he wants. And even in the very end of the movie, he like needs to be guided back to the beginning, even though, because I have the Blu-ray, I was able to pause and go through all like the flashes he's getting after he beats up that guy.
Wait, can I just say one more thing? Sure. That's like that scene when he trips out and then like the guts come out. And then he's like scraping up his, like, that was fucking exceptional. That felt so real. Like, I love the like the psychedelic stuff that happens in this movie, especially when perfect.
It's very good. It's flashes of him becoming a big melty baby, and it's flashes of him and Kaneda on the playground as children. And so it's like the beginning and the future, and he needs to be guided away from the future and being a big melty baby back to the beginning. And the idea that Kaori has these needs that he doesn't know how to address, he just kind of has her because all the biker punks have a girlfriend. Like, we see another thing that's not in the manga is just all the biker punks just have these like hanger-on girls. Kaneda, of course, like kicks his to the curb the moment he meets Kay. He's like, get away from me, stop flirting with me, I hate this.
And I love it when she's like, let's get, like, these biker kick chick guys haven't got their bikes anymore. Let's get out of here. It's boring. Like, I love that. Love that sort of like, fuck you vibe.
Okay, I'm gonna lay down some Akira hot takes, both for the manga and the anime. Step one, the manga really does not have a protagonist, but if there is a protagonist, it's the Colonel. And as in the manga and in the anime, if everyone just listened to the Colonel, we'd be fine. Like,
gotta trust that, him.
He is right every time. In the manga, he's got even better characterization because they have him very – he's a very quick read of situations, and he'll do things where he'll like order something, and then 2 minutes later he's like, wait, no, that's not it. We need to get down to the second level because that's actually where they're going. Like, this is a feint. It made me watch the Colonel a lot more sympathetically because like he's kind of depicted as like an authoritarian meathead in the movie, kind of. I mean, he also correctly diagnoses the sickness of the society, but he has no solutions. He's the caretaker of these atomic bombs that will go off someday. But in the manga especially, he is the only person who seems to have consistent motivations and is present for all the major actions of the plot, even after because the manga – spoilers, I guess. We've spoiled the shit out of this. The second Akira incident blows up Neo-Tokyo again, and then there's like a weird like bandit empire that exists in the rubble that is theoretically run by Akira, but is also theoretically run by Tetsuo, but is actually run by this former gangster named the Taicho. And the colonel's still there, and he's still working with the scientist, and his plan is still to kill Tetsuo. And just except for the gang of bikers like driving off into the distance at the end of the manga, and that's kind of the final image, he gets the last word, really, of the colonel. He's just like, yeah, I'm retiring. My whole point was to make sure that Tetsuo didn't blow up the world. Mission accomplished. I'm done. Because they like offer him to like join the empire, and he says no. So I really liked the colonel this time around. Dude's got a head on his shoulders. He does not panic. He's capable. He does not overestimate his abilities, unlike every other character in the entire manga. So I'm Colonel Pilled, authoritarian maxing.
The one thing that I thought when I watched it this like the anime this time, and maybe this is just the state of the world as it is and my trust in authority, but like, when they reveal what Akira is, which is just a bunch of like brain stems and whatever, like sliced up into like
samples,
things, like samples. Like even then, I didn't trust what he was saying implicitly. Like he gave the whole things like they're nothing. They're absolutely nothing. Like why do you even bother? And it's just like, I don't believe you. Like I think he's a clever character, and I do agree with what you're saying, but like, do I trust everything that that guy is saying? No, I don't. And I feel that that was...
You shouldn't trust the military.
Yeah. And I feel that that kind of came to fruition when Akira, like, revives at the end.
I think the thing about that scene is like, a really good liar can tell the truth, but they omit.
Yes.
And yes, everything the colonel tells him is true, but it's what he's omitting about how Akira ended up there, what that part they played in creating him, and what would happen to him if he came back, etc. Tell him the truth, because it's easier to tell the truth than lie.
Yeah. And he's got an interesting line in the movie too, where he's like, my job is not to believe or disbelieve. My job is to act or not act. And if that is not a very profound character note, I don't know what is. He does not care if Akira is the Messiah. His job is to keep Neo Tokyo 3 from blowing up again.
And he has a love for the city as well. Like genuinely and I thought that was just like, I don't know, kind of a sweetness.
A very sympathetic portrayal of a fascistic military dictator.
Yeah. We don't have enough of them right now.
Yeah, and yeah. Well, I mean, like when Tetsuo goes all melty giant baby, like the colonel tries to protect the numbers. He tries to protect the other psychic children. Like he's like shooting his Desert Eagle at this like ever expanding mass, and he's like it's not going to work, but like that his job is to act, and he does that. Another take related to what you said about the Akira samples. I like Akira as just a bunch of petri dishes. In the manga, he is a catatonic boy who's kind of just like led around, and he has this thing where he like resonates with the other psychics and kind of amplifies them, but he has no will of his own. Like anything that happens is in reaction to something happening to another psychic around him, which makes it very funny early in the manga when everyone's like, be careful, like anything could set Akira off. And then for a volume and a half, he's just being dragged around streets while people shoot at him. And then they release him. Tetsuo releases him, and then like different people get a hold of him, and it's just these running gun battles, which Otomo, dude loves running gun battles in like Urban Decay, because that is I would say 40% of the manga is just people shooting at other people around destroyed buildings. And then finally like a major event happens. One of the children is shot in the head and it sets Akira off, and that's how we get the second explosion in the manga. But I like Akira as this kind of, he's not a person. And so when you bring him out and he's just these collection of petri dishes, I think that that's a lot more powerful than him just being this weird, quiet kid who doesn't seem to like react to the world around him. When Tetsuo is sitting on the throne, just surrounded by the sample jars of Akira, is so I think the most iconic shot for me in the movie.
Yeah, and then it also like harks back to like just like, well, what makes something deified? Is it that person actually existing, or is it the belief that that person is there and what those items, those relics hold?
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, they're nothing. They're just like petri dishes, but then they do actually kind of become Akira at the very end, which is a thing, which I...
It just, I mean, it's the ending. It's
the birth of the universe.
I'm fine with that, because the manga's explanation of psychic power comes from microglass ampules of saline inserted directly into the human brain and electrified. I was reading that and I was like, Otomo, you need to hire a different research assistant, because this is the craziest shit I've ever read in any sort of remotely hard sci-fi thing. Very, very thin glass tubes filled with saline, and then they ran electricity through them, changes your brain DNA and makes you a psychic. And he leaves that aside, and we get much more poetic later on in the manga, where Miyoko, especially the like, she appears as like a cameo in the movie, the huge afro lady who's like doing the prayer beads, and she eventually falls off and dies when the bridge collapses. She's a huge character in the manga.
Oh, really?
And largely a source of very tedious exposition. A lot of the manga is people saying, where's someone? And a lot of the manga is Miyoko saying, go to this person who's over there. But she says, like, we used harsh fertilizer on humanity, and this is the plant we've grown. And that's, I think, a much more compelling picture of like what the psychic is. We have ruined the earth. We have ruined humanity as a polyorganism in some way. And that is the forced evolution that Akira represents is necessary, is because we fucked up. Modernity fucked up. We need to grow beyond this. And I'm not entirely sure in either the manga or the movie, like what the next step after that looks like. And I guess it's powerful that you expect the audience to kind of take that next step. But yeah, the hard science attempts to explain what's going on with Akira and Tetsuo and the numbers is kind of whack.
I always love it in these old school, these 80s, 70s sci-fi, where they're able to like predict like human experimentation and psychic abilities, but they can't have thought of the mobile phone, because that would have solved a lot of problems by the sounds of things.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. If people could have called each other. There's even an argument where Joker, the head of the clown gang, who also turns out to be a really important character after
in the second half.
It ends up he's like a mechanical genius, and he's like their fix-it guy, and also just the guy that they call Fatty, because it's the 80s and it's manga. But they're arguing about like what Akira is functioning as, and Kaneda's like, oh, he's like a telephone switchboard, and like he's connecting all these psychics like telephones, and Joker's like, that's dumb. It's like radio is much more modern technology. You should use that as your metaphor. And they have a little argument about it. And telephones, old hat. We're talking about like high band radio. That's futuristic. So in general, I've alluded a lot to the manga. I meant to keep it more cordoned off, but I since this is the first time I've read the manga and then I watched the movie immediately after, I have a lot more live thoughts. I like the richness of the manga. I love its lore. There's I talk too much about alcohol on this podcast. A lot of times if you're trying to like bring out flavors of a spirit, you'll dilute it either with ice or with soda water, and you kind of... there's flavors you couldn't possibly taste when they're all compressed together. And that's kind of how I feel about the manga. It's a much more diluted version without implying like huge thunderstorm rolling in. I hope it's blocking all the sound.
Yeah, you could hear that.
There was fireworks and thunderstorm. It's fucking crazy. America.
4th of July, baby.
I don't want to say it's like attenuated or weakened, but it is like... The apocalypse happens a lot slower. The city is destroyed, and then for the next like something odd months, there's like these different factions squabbling over like literally the ashes of what was, you know, formerly the most populous city on the planet. So I like that, but I think the characterization is better in the movie. I think the sense of momentum, the sense of inevitability, there's this like, oh, Akira's going to go crazy. Tetsuo's going to go off. And in the movie, they say that. And then 10 minutes later, Tetsuo is blowing up into a giant slime baby. And in the book, it's two more volumes before Tetsuo finally blows up. And they're like, oh, his power's deleting his personality. And once his personality's gone, he's just going to be just like that amoeba that's just eating the world. And in the movie, like, again, they say that. And then like, three scenes later, that's happening, as opposed to like two volumes later. I can't imagine having read this as it come out and like, oh, some shit's going to happen. And then you're reading it a year later, some shit's going to happen. And you're,
the film is truly all killer, no filler.
Yeah, it's a real streamlining of it. And the only thing
that's
that
what
I would
it feels like reading One Piece, Ben.
I bet. But the one thing I do like is that, and every time I watch the movie, I'm always tricked because I have a false memory of the ending. And it was really gratifying to have that be the ending in the manga to some extent, because Akira and the kids take Tetsuo back to the beginning where they become the fuel for the Big Bang, is my vague assessment of the ending.
Yeah.
And then it happens. And then there's this stream of matter and light. And it's coming at, and I always expect that to turn into lights on the highway. I always expect it to be the callback to the bikes on, like, the flow of matter becomes the taillights of ghost bikes on the highway. And then we kind of end with the ED to Dirty Pair, the TV show or something, where it's just kind of like this kind of like dreamlike nighttime highway. And in the books that it is, they drive off and these like streams follow them and the city rebuilds itself behind them. And it's obviously like a fantasy or kind of like this resonance of like everything has changed, the world has changed completely, but these are still kids racing their bikes down city streets. And even if you destroy the entire world, there will be kids racing their bikes down city streets. And I want that in the movie, and I'm glad that I'm validated that Otomo, yeah, after making the movie, was like, actually, I do need to bring it back to the bikes at the very end of the day.
Yeah. I mean, in what the film opens on and sort of ends on, it is that shot, which at first you think is like a sort of a cross-section of a brain or a cell or something, and then resolves into Tokyo. Like this idea of a city as an organism.
Yeah.
Humans not as individuals, but as a collective. And so I think that as a final shot, it does get down to what they're trying to tell us with the film.
Yeah.
I'm glad we did a rewatch, because it has held up pretty flawlessly, I think.
I agree.
It is interesting, though. I didn't realize that the manga continued for like another 2 years after the anime ended.
There or thereabouts.
So I do wonder if Akira, the movie, was originally how he intended to end it. And then they were kind of like, you got a hot ticket on your hands, son. Like, you got to keep this train a rolling because people fucking love it.
It was hard for me to tell if what we were seeing was influence of the movie and its reaction on the final chapters of the manga, or whether Otomo is just one of those people who plans the big plot beats ahead. Because there is stuff that gets feathered back in earlier, I think I mentioned before. Mm-hmm. There are these visual elements, there are these characters that appear earlier in the movie than in the manga. But my instinct is that he had this written out, a compressed outline of what he was going to do. But it is interesting to see this process of self-abridgment, and I think an enormously successful process of self-abridgment. Otomo seems very able to kill his darlings, which is especially rare in any media.
I think that the kind of remarkable thing of when we look back at people like him and like Miyazaki and what he did, for instance, for Nausicaa, is people who draw entire mangas and then direct the films. I cannot think of any modern example of a mangaka who has gone on to direct their anime, mm-hmm, or even the reverse, anime directors who've gone on to draw manga. Like, it feels like we've really specialized and that you don't get these, maybe for good, because like, I mean, obviously the person that they're trying to ape here is old Mr. Tezuka, who did not meet a role he did not want to do himself.
Yeah. Look, you can't trust anyone else to do your work for you. That's the Tezuka story.
The only modern-day example I can think of, Duncan, is again, One Piece, like Oda, not for the anime, but for the movies. He gets pretty involved.
Oh, cool.
Since, I think, Strong World, I think it was, where he was like, these movies are slumping, I'm going to actually get involved. Like, the general story of the films, I believe, are also kind of like run past him. Same, I believe, with the live action. They got a they got him involved a lot early on with like the pre-production and like
it's still though a leap from that to actually being the director.
Yeah.
Yes. Agreed.
Yes,
agreed.
Yes. Being a brand steward is one thing. Being a steward of your own brand is one thing, and being like. Being like Miyazaki or Otomo, who write manga and then adapt them into movies, I feel like that could go really wrong, but it doesn't here, and that's actually one of the most pleasant surprises. Is I've always heard from people that the Akira manga is better, that it's richer, that the character arcs are more meaningful. I don't know, it's internet opinions, Duncan. I don't know.
The internet does not need to see my face to know the face I was pulling then.
And it's easy to say the book was better, and there are parts of the book that are better, but especially with Tezuka.
He loved,
Tezuka!
Tezuka!
Miyazaki!
Tezuka Misei! Tezuka Misei!
Tezuka! Especially with Tetsuo, who, like, as Duncan alluded to, just becomes a crazy murderer. We have one scene of him being like Kaneda's like little buddy, and then the very next scene he gets whisked off to a hospital. He comes back and joins the clown gang because they're the ones who can get him drugs, so he like turns on his friends instantly, and then he just never stops killing people for the next five volumes until finally he and Akira turn into two spheres that become a gamete, and then they go back in time. Kaneda redeclares the Great Tokyo Empire and says, foreigners out, only Japanese here now.
Right.
So it is interesting that we got a better chance to get to know these characters. And Kaneda, while I enjoyed in the manga how like selfish and flighty he is, he's kind of just a stand-up guy who's mostly, his biggest problem is that he's a teenager.
Yeah.
And, you know, Tetsuo is shown to care about something and not just like prosecuting a decade-old grudge against his best friend. And part of that's the voice performances, part of that's the music, part of that's how much more confident the movie is to show and not tell. Like I said, Lady Miyoko is just always in people's heads being like, this is Tetsuo's greatest form. I'm like, I know he's a giant baby. I know he's big. Like, you don't need to have a character on screen being like, he's big. Look at how big he is. He's a big baby.
Which is exactly what the American live action would do. Like, I can just imagine that council scene, and then it will just cut to like Nezumi like rubbing his hands, being like,
I mean, he already kind of is.
Yeah, but it's a lot more subtle.
It's not that anime is free of that. Since you two, just a month ago, were describing Akane Benashe doing the exact same thing.
But when I watched that scene, like, I didn't clock Nezumi the first time. And then I went back and was like, oh shit, he's there. But he's not like full front center until the very end where he is in the foreground. But he's just like sitting there, and they don't really draw him, like make any attention to like draw his presence or like let you know.
Well, that's what you get with these rich frames. And he's got that scene, and then he's got the scene in his office where they're shoveling documents into the fireplace and he's packing a suitcase full of money and stock certificates and just chowing down on aspirin because, you know, I posted this in the chat and I still stand by it. If you have a serious heart condition, I would recommend not being an anti-government mole, especially not a corrupt anti-government mole in charge of a resistance cell.
Up? I missed that. I miss his heart problems.
Like, no, he's taking aspirin for a heart problem because, like, if you're stressed and feeling angina, aspirin like widens the blood vessels so that you can get more blood flow. So if you don't have a heart attack, but then he just like eats an entire bottle and then just dies as Ryu walks after him with a bullet wound in his. We'll probably cut this, but like when Nezu shoots Ryu, the first bullet hits and then he shoots like five more times and the bullets go everywhere and he can't hit a single thing. Yeah. It's so those small details. Yeah,
you'll have to confirm this for me, Ben, but it was interesting watching in that scene you were talking about where Ryo's following Nezumi through this alley and they come out the other end and there's the riot happening. Ryo has this sort of like blank sort of despairing look all the time where he's following, he's like just staring into the middle distance. Look, maybe I imagined it, but I swear, but when he's looking out and he's seeing all this chaos, he smiles And I would have missed it if I hadn't freeze the frame right then.
I think that's true.
Yeah.
It's something that's explored more in the manga, but I think you can do it in a really good shorthand. It's just that the resistance cell of K, Ryu, the guy who looks exactly like Ryu, but he's wearing like yes. a coat and a hat.
Yes.
that's an even bigger problem in the, because they go on a mission together and one of them dies. And like, thank goodness, like he shouted his name, because otherwise I'd be like, Ryu died? I remember. but yeah, like the resistance cell has different objectives, and the idea that there's this corrupt mole who's like feeding information to a resistance cell to make the government fall so that he can make a power grab and like, you know, buy up more companies, and especially for like, you know, you Brexit veterans, I guess MAGA in America too, like destroying the government to make a tidy profit. It feels very prescient. But the idea that there's these true believers, and you know, one of them stops by the corrupt politician's office. He's like, hey, you shouldn't come here. And he's like, you betrayed us.
I mean, these are all beautifully hand-drawn cells. And like, I can imagine the Akira slide cell being like 10 grand, say, as an example. But I really want to know how much the cell of an old man filled with paracetamol, how much that's going to go for on the auction. Just, and then like hanging it up on their wall, be like, yeah. Like, why would you want that one?
Yeah, an ugly rat-like old man dying from his own hubris and over-medication. Speaking of dying, let's call it there. Wait, do you want to have any last comments?
I am looking forward to watching the IMAX.
Yeah, I'm going to try to put it on my calendar. I really enjoyed this. I had one of the early printings where it had like not the hypersonic effect level audio track, but had the, which we'll link in the notes, the hypersonic effect. But it did have like a nice like 192 kilobits and beautiful bitrate. Just a gorgeous disc. And I can't imagine how the 4K will look, but probably good.
I want to know, like the revolution scenes, especially that bit where like they push over the bus, like the truck, like it feels like that was kind of rotoscoped. It was so believable.
I'm sure there's reference images of riots you can go to.
I mean, I imagine there is that much production detail somewhere on the internet, but it would be nice to know if that is a...
They released a Japanese TV documentary at the time about the making of it. We'll have a link to in the notes of the episode.
Oh, where do you watch that? Is it an illegals?
Well, this is just someone has uploaded it to YouTube.
Oh, right, okay.
It's on the Blu-ray I have. I meant to watch it, but then, like I said, I've been really busy.
Yeah, no.
I've been busy
no
binging the Akira manga. From my local library. My society hasn't completely crumbled.
Yeah, I also read the multiple volumes of Akira at my local library. So as a final note, let's just remember, libraries are the best. Yay.
Praise the Lord, library. Great library empire. All right. Join us next time. We're going to keep on this sci-fi train. We are going to be talking about policing and governance in the cities of the future. There's a new Ghost in the Shell out. I've been watching Dominion Tank Police, which is surprisingly the same damn thing. And I don't know, maybe I'll even watch Cyberpunk Edgerunners. We'll just keep going. Sounds good? So yeah, join us. Rate, review, and subscribe to us on the podcast platform of your choice. Find us on Facebook, search for Keyframes Podcast. Find us on Blue Sky, Keyframes Pod. Email us questions, keyframespodcast@gmail.com. And most of all, tell a friend.
But not just any friend, Ben. I would tell the friend who's thinking of maybe just joining a biker gang.
Tell a friend you fucking hate and you just wish you could become a big giant baby and crush him. Just crush him. And crush your girlfriend too. And crush the entire world.
Just fucking blow up everything.
Fuck them all.
Fuck them all.
Alternately, just tell him to take an aspirin.
Tell a friend who's got a heart condition and is a government mole.
To a penny, right? Mm.
Tell a friend who you think you can trust, but he looks like a literal rat.
He does look so much like a rat. It's wild. It's wild that they're like, there's a mole. Who is it? Is it the guy who looks like a rat and is called Nezumi? Like, no, it couldn't be him.
Has two buck teeth.
Two buck teeth. He's balding. He has like a nasty like fringe that's down to his shoulders. He's tiny. He's hunched. He looks like a Peter Pettigrew from the Harry Potter movies. Just real bastard. Tell that guy about our podcast.
That Peter guy worked out right in the anime.
Definitely did. Like... Siding with Voldemort is always a good call. No one suffers from it. If there's one thing I know about the Harry Potter books, it's that.
He probably did it under duress or something. I can't remember to make him actually good.
Probably got a sweet gold hand from it.
Absolutely, like a gold hand job. Yeah, like
absolutely. Whoa.
Oh, sorry.
Not that kind of dark arts, Andy. Say goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Goodbye.